Today is Wednesday, October 27th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Junaid Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Sudan military arrests pro-democracy activists as pressure mounts.
Actually, we've been in close contact with regional leaders, including in the Gulf, to make sure that we're closely coordinating and sending a clear message.
Plus, aid agencies race to stave off hunger in Afghanistan.
International aid agencies say more than half of the country's population, a record 22.8 million people, face acute hunger in the coming months.
Also, climate warning bells ahead of Glasgow COP26 summit next week. Our top story today is in Sudan. Sudanese security forces detained several prominent pro-democracy figures, family members and activists said Wednesday, as international pressure mounted on the country's military to walk back the takeover staged earlier this week. On Tuesday, White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. administration is looking at a full range of economic tools to respond to the military takeover in Sudan and has been in close contact with Gulf countries. Also, the African Union on Tuesday suspended Sudan's participation in all activities until the restoration of the civilian-led authority. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres also condemned the takeover shortly before the Security Council met in private to discuss it.
Actually, we've been in close contact with regional leaders, including in the Gulf, to make sure that we're closely coordinating and sending a clear message to the military in Sudan that they should first and foremost cease any violence against innocent civilians, that they should release those who have been detained, and they should get back on a democratic path. We will continue to do that. We'll stay closely coordinated and aligned with all of the stakeholders who we believe have influence in Khartoum. Second, we have made clear that we are deeply alarmed. The Secretary Blinken put out a very strong statement yesterday by the actions taken 36 hours ago by the Sudanese security forces, including the arrest of multiple civilian officials and the detention of Prime Minister Hamdok. We believe it undermines the country's transition to democratic civilian rule, and we firmly reject the assertions that this is within the authority of the military leadership in Sudan. From our perspective, these actions are utterly unacceptable. They contravene the constitutional declaration, but more importantly, they contravene the aspiration of the Sudanese people. In terms of the tools you ask about, we've already made clear we are pressing pause on significant aspects of our economic assistance to Sudan, and we will look at the full range of economic tools available to us in coordination and consultation with regional actors and other key countries to make sure that we are trying to push the entire Sudanese political process back in a positive direction after this significant and alarming setback.
That's U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. Sudan's top general, Abdel Fattah Burhan, defended the army's seizure of power, saying he had ousted the government to avoid civil war. Sudanese stayed home and government offices were deserted for a second day in protest on Tuesday. A mass protest against the military takeover is scheduled for October 30th. The office of Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says he and his wife, who were detained after the military seized power, were allowed to return to their home in Khartoum. Sudan's military takeover has implications for its neighbors in terms of diplomatic relations, long-standing disputes, and stability. For a look at those implications, VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with Jonas Horner, a senior analyst covering Sudan for the International Crisis Group. They start by talking about regional factors that played into the Sudan's military decision to take over the government.
Look, Sudan has become increasingly geopolitically and regionally relevant and tied into dynamics, both stretching towards the Sahel and then, you know, up looking north towards Libya and Egypt and certainly going eastward towards Ethiopia. I would say key in today's considerations really are questions of the ongoing conflict between Egypt and Ethiopia and Sudan over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. This is you know, conflict being fought out at negotiating tables, but it is a very existential question for each of these countries. Egypt is very keen to see a military dispensation in Sudan because they believe that they will take care of their interests best when it comes to representing Egyptian concerns over the dam. Ethiopia is probably one of the countries in the region most likely to want to see a successful civilian transition in Sudan because they could rely perhaps on improved relations to buy electricity that might come from the dam, and the civilians would not be so prone to perhaps towing the Egyptian line when it came to that particular issue.
In addition to the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam issue, we also have the issue of the conflict in Western Ethiopia, and in recent months since that conflict began, there have been some disputes between Sudan and Ethiopia over borders and immigrant flows, or migrant flows rather. How does this military action in Sudan affect what's playing out in Western Ethiopia?
Well, there will be some repercussions, I suspect, though those are going to be very hard to discern as things stand. You know, the real concern for the Ethiopian government over Sudan's engagement in Tigray is that the Sudan Armed Forces are traditional allies of the Tigrayan Defense Forces or the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the TPLF. And the concern is that the military, if it is indeed in the ascendancy, and that there is no mediation from civilians, that they will, you know, more robustly perhaps support the Tigrayans as they fight against the central government in Addis Ababa.
Now, are there other regional implications? Is this something that would bleed over perhaps into South Sudan, or could there be problems, issues with other neighbors such as Chad?
I think because we're only hours after the fact, it's tough to make some predictions about that. But I think what is important to say is that the demonstrative effect of a successful civilian transition in Khartoum would have implications across the region. You know, there are plenty of autocratic governments that are in Sudan's immediate neighborhood, and then even, you know, across the Red Sea and elsewhere too, who will, you know, concern themselves with what inspiring effect a successful civilian transition might have to their own populations. And then you start going back to questions of the Arab Spring and the way that period was both begun and also crushed in the end. So, you know, those sorts of questions of authoritarianism and democracy and stabilization are all at play here.
That was Jonas Horner with the International Questions Group speaking with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson from Nairobi. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced plans to provide up to $102 million to expand the U.S. strategic partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN. The announcement came Thursday during a virtual summit with the 10-nation bloc, as VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara reports.
Brunei's head of state, Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah, hosted Tuesday's virtual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN.
This year, we have made significant progress in strengthening our cooperation with external partners.
One of those external partners is the U.S. During the summit, President Joe Biden announced plans to provide up to $102 million to expand its strategic partnership with the bloc, including $40 million to help address the current COVID-19 pandemic and strengthen ASEAN's ability to prevent, detect, and respond to future pandemics.
Our bottom line is that ASEAN is essential. I want to say that it's essential to the regional architecture of the Indo-Pacific. And the United States is committed to ASEAN's centrality. You know, it's a linchpin. It's a linchpin for maintaining the resilience, the prosperity, and security of our shared region.
President Donald Trump participated at the ASEAN summit in 2017, but skipped the following years. The economically dynamic regional bloc of 10 Southeast Asian nations is seen as key to countering a rising China. The trade group, U.S.-ASEAN Business Council, welcomes America's re-engagement. Mark Mealy is Senior Vice President for Policy at the U.S.-ASEAN Business Council.
We're talking about a region that by 2030 is going to be one of the largest regional economies in the world. We're talking about a part of the world where over 21 different states in the United States have annual exports of over $1 billion U.S. in goods to the 10 countries in Southeast Asia.
While the U.S. is seen as a security guarantor against Chinese military ambitions, Washington is lagging behind Beijing in economic ties. ASEAN is China's largest trading partner, Both are part of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. Signed in 2020, it's the world's biggest free trade agreement, but excludes the U.S. The U.S. is also left out of the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP, a free trade agreement formerly known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The 2016 TPP was promoted by President Barack Obama.
We just officially terminated TPP.
But abandoned by President Donald Trump in 2017. Prashant Parameswaran is a fellow with the Wilson Center's Asia program.
On several issues, whether it's trade or climate, the United States plays an important role in setting the table and then sometimes leaves the table. And these countries like Japan and ASEAN are able to continue on the legacy thereafter. But I do think the United States ends up losing.
While U.S.-China rivalry has intensified, ASEAN members underscore the need to cooperate with both nations, but at the same time ensure freedom of navigation, including managing tensions in the Taiwan Strait. Indonesian Coordinating Minister for Maritime Affairs and Investment, Luhut Panjaitan.
What's the benefit for the conflict happening in that area? What's the benefit? Who get the benefit? Nobody. Nobody. COVID is enough created the problem.
Myanmar did not attend this year's ASEAN summit since the group banned its junta leaders for ignoring a peace roadmap agreed to 6 months ago following the country's military coup. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
Afghanistan is facing a severe food shortage. With winter coming, supply lines to large parts of the country will be cut off by snow. Aid agencies say they are rushing to stave off crippling hunger and malnutrition in freezing cold temperatures. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim met Afghan families struggling to feed their children. This is their story.
A hungry child crying for milk, a common sight in today's Afghanistan. International aid agencies say more than half of the country's population, a record 22.8 million people, face acute hunger in the coming months. That includes millions of children. Two such children live with Seema in Kabul.
Previously, when their father worked, we used to give these children a bottle of milk each, twice a day. Now both of them share one bottle of milk for the whole day. Two bottles last 48 hours.
Everyone in this household, mother, father, son, and daughter, have lost their jobs. With no income, putting food on the table is a challenge, Seema says.
It's been 3 weeks since we cooked a meal. We only eat dry bread. But if we eat it in the afternoon, we don't have anything for dinner. If we eat it for dinner, we don't have anything for breakfast.
4 decades of war has left the country destitute. Nearly 3/4 of the Afghan government's budget was supported by foreign funding. That funding stopped when the Taliban took over. The United States has also frozen nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's assets. Now, the country is facing an economic meltdown. At a food distribution center in Kabul, set up by the World Food Program, the lines are long. Mary Ellen McGroarty is the country director of WFP in Afghanistan.
WFP received 100 million, so that's allowing us now to get food into the country very quickly. But we still have a huge shortfall as we approach into winter. You know, we need another 100 million now before the end of the year and 300 million going into the beginning of 2022.
The situation has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic and a severe drought, the second in 4 years. Many have lost their jobs. Many with jobs have not been paid in months. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced by conflict and drought. Nazia is one such displaced person.
I used to have food and clothes, but when I fled, I couldn't bring anything with me. Even my feet are injured.
Afghanistan is now among the world's worst humanitarian crises. The aid rations allow families like this one to have a decent meal, but not for long. Whatever help they're getting today will only last them a month. And with the winter coming, they don't know how they will survive the year. Ayesha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
This is the Voice of America. Iran's president is saying that a cyber attack that shut down gasoline stations across the country aimed to get, quote, people angry by creating disorder and disruption, unquote. Ebrahim Raisi comments, the first since Tuesday's attack did not blame anyone specifically for the incident. However, he suggested anti-Iranian forces were behind the cyber attack. A Brazilian Senate committee has recommended that President Jair Bolsonaro face a series of criminal indictments for actions and omissions related to the world's second highest COVID-19 death toll. The 7-4 vote by the 11-member committee on Tuesday ends a six-month investigation of the government's handling of the pandemic. It formally approves a report calling for Bolsonaro to stand trial on charges ranging from charlatanism and inciting crime to misuse of public funds and crimes against humanity. More than 600,000 people have died of COVID-19 in Brazil. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Turkey is threatening to launch a new military operation against Syrian Kurdish forces after a deadly attack in Syrian territory where Turkish forces are present. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With Ankara blaming the Syrian Kurdish group, the YPG, for this month's fatal car bombing in the Turkish-controlled Syrian Afrin region, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan indicated he has reached his limit. Erdogan said, "We have no patience left in some areas that are a source of terror attacks aimed at our country from Syria." Turkey accuses the YPG of having links to Kurdish separatists fighting in Turkish territory, a charge the group denies. Erdogan says Turkish forces and Syrian rebels backed by Turkey will seek to oust the YPG from the strategic town of Tel Rafat. Ankara believes that is the launch pad of the Kurdish group's attacks against Turkish forces in Syria. But Russian forces control Tel Rafat, along with the airspace. Özgür Ünlü Hüsükçükle is an analyst at the George Marshall Fund office in Ankara.
Russian cooperation, let's say Russian facilitation, would be of utmost importance because Russia has air dominance area, and because it is actually the area that the Tarifa is not too close to the Turkish border, any Turkish operation would be very difficult without Russian approval.
Ankara has long sought Tel Rafat, as it would link three areas of Syria under Turkish military control. But with the Syrian town, a vital transportation hub, and close to Syria's second largest city, Aleppo, some observers say Moscow will be wary of giving Ankara such a valuable prize. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
A UN report says extreme weather and the impact of global change killed thousands of people and resulted in enormous economic losses in all parts of Asia last year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A multi-agency report coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization warns the lives and livelihoods of millions of people across Asia are being threatened by floods, tropical cyclones, drought, and other weather and climate hazards. The report says extreme weather and climate events are affecting agriculture, food, and water security, worsening health risks, and causing the mass displacement of vulnerable migrants and refugees. It says the cost in damaged infrastructure and lost ecosystems runs into hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Among the many weather anomalies hitting Asia is temperature rise. WMO spokeswoman Clara Nullis notes Asia had its warmest year on record in 2020.
The most extreme temperature that we saw last year was in a Siberian town, Verkhoyansk. We saw an amazingly incredible temperature of 38 degrees Celsius. We're still investigating whether this is a new record for north of the Arctic Circle.
The report finds sea surface temperatures and ocean warming in and around Asia are increasing more than the global average. It says temperatures in parts of the Arctic Ocean have been warming at three times the global average during the 1982-2020 period. A major problem affecting the region is that of melting glaciers, which will have a huge impact on food and water security security. High Mountain Asia is home to approximately 100,000 kilometers of glaciers centered on the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. Nullis says the region has the largest volumes of ice outside of the polar regions. She notes it is the source of 10 important rivers in Asia upon which millions of people depend.
Glacier retreat is accelerating. It's projected that glacier mass will decrease by 20 to 40% by 2050. This will affect about 750 million people in the region. Major ramifications, obviously, for global sea level rise, regional water cycles, and in the short term, more hazards such as landslides, avalanches, etc.
The report finds floods and storms in 2020 affected about 50 million people in Asia, killed more than 5,000, and has resulted in more than $400 billion in accumulated losses just in China, India, and Japan. Meteorologists say the costs of extreme events in Asia are rising and warn the trends are expected to continue in the future. They urge nations to adapt to the climate-changing events and to invest in renewable energy and other protective technologies. They say the high-stakes investments will result in multiple socioeconomic benefits. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Global pledges to cut greenhouse gas emissions are just a fraction of what's needed to prevent catastrophic global warming. That's the warning from the United Nations ahead of the critical COP26 climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland next week, where world leaders will try to agree on further action to combat global warming. Harry Ridgewood looks at what's at stake ahead of the meeting.
At the 2015 Paris Climate Summit, world leaders pledged to restrict global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. But those promises are not being matched with policies, according to the United Nations Emissions Gap Report published Tuesday. It warns that new commitments to reduce emissions made in the run-up to the Glasgow summit, known as Nationally Determined Contributions, or NDCs, will reduce greenhouse gases by just 7.5% by 2030 compared to previous pledges. Restricting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius would require emissions cuts of 55%. Petteri Tallas is the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization.
So far, we have heard lots of political support for enhanced ambition of mitigation, but the concrete pledges have still been missing. And at the moment, we are heading towards 2.5 to 3 degrees warming rather than 1.5 to 2 degrees.
So what does that mean for the planet and for humankind? Scientists say climate change is already increasing the frequency and intensity of heat waves. A recent report from Chatham House calculated that globally, heat-related mortality has increased by nearly 54% among the elderly since the turn of the century, reaching 296,000 deaths in 2018. Daniel Quiggin is a co-author of the report.
We expect around about 400 million people to be experiencing heat waves to the extent that they're no longer able to work outside.
Heat waves and droughts would have a big impact on global food security. Crop failures and the increased prevalence of pests and diseases, such as the locust plague in East Africa last year, would lead to soaring prices. Scientists say the outcome of the Glasgow summit will likely affect each and every one of us on a warming planet Earth. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The United Nations Security Council and the United States have imposed sanctions on a Libyan official over the alleged abuse and torture of migrants in a detention center. The Security Council and the U.S. said in a separate statement late Tuesday that Osama Al-Kuni is the de facto head of a detention center in the North African nation's west. Migrants there are said to have been subjected to torture, sexual and gender-based violence, and human trafficking. Libya emerged as a major conduit for African migrants hoping to reach Europe after the death of the country's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi in a NATO-backed uprising in 2011. The country subsequently slid into chaos. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Powell Dawson, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.